Good morning. My name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
We're here today with James Crow, co-founder of the new Vaulted Gallery in the Norblad building, recent Astoria transplant, a dual citizen, born and raised in Dublin. And James, thanks so much. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before the show started, we were talking a little bit about what brought you to Astoria. And we talked about how from the late 90s to basically just last year or a year or two ago, you guys were living in L.A. Tell us a little bit about the work that you were doing down there and, you know, what you spent your time doing down there.
So I was a television editor, working mostly in sketch comedy. And I had moved to Los Angeles in 98, straight out of college, with a degree in communications. And I was just eager to get into the business. I just wanted to, be in film.
What was the first gig like? How did you break into film?
So I arrived in Los Angeles with two bags of clothes, a couple of $1,000s in my pocket, and I had two phone numbers on a piece of paper that had been given to me by a film producer in Dublin that had sat me down for a couple of hours before I came out and given me kind of, you know, a little intro course on Hollywood. And he gave me two phone numbers, and I called both of those phone numbers, and one of them called me back and told me to come in and meet with a producer who was hiring PAs, and they gave me a job.
Wow, that sounds easy. That sounds like what everybody wishes it would be like.
It was pretty much the only break I needed to get going. Mm-hmm. I got a job as a PA, and I had a couple nice things kind of, I got the rub of the green go my way, and before I knew it, I was working in a post-production department, training in as an assistant editor, and I found myself in the union, which is, if you don't know anything about unions in Hollywood, is the golden ticket. It's like winning the lottery, getting into one of the unions. So I got into the union as an assistant editor, and it was kind of, there was no looking back after that.
What drew you to comedy? I mean, was that a conscious decision to say, okay, this is the type of stuff I want to work in? And
No, very much not a conscious decision. When I moved to Los Angeles, my plan was to get a master's in cinematography. And if I had been given my choice of any job, I would have ended up working as a cameraman in the natural history end of the spectrum. Like they didn't exist at the time, but the Planet Earth series was kind of
the dream
what made. Was in my mind. But the first offer that came my way after I had been assisting for a few years was to edit a sketch comedy show. It was the second season of The Andy Dick Show for MTV back in 2000. And
throwback. That's like traveling back in time.
Very much so. Very much so. And I was probably hugely unqualified for the job. In fact, they were editing on an edit system that I had never used. So I was to go in on a Saturday and take a look around and cut some stuff for them and see if they wanted to give me a job. And on Friday morning, the day before, I still had never sat down in front of an Avid. I'd worked on other nonlinear editing systems, but never an Avid. So I booked some time with a tutor in a facility in Burbank, and I did a couple of hours where he showed me the ropes, and he just walked away with that. He said, oh, you clearly know how the editing system, the systems work. You just need to learn the quirks of this one, and you'll be fine. And he's like, just go down, sit down, do the job, you'll get through it. And I pulled it off. Wow. I convinced them I knew what I was doing, and they gave me a job.
I feel like a lot of people are maybe familiar with, you know, what Hollywood produces and the output of Hollywood, but very few people get to kind of see behind the curtain, you know, and see what's going on there. Is there anything that almost 20 years in this type of work has taught you that you think maybe people would be surprised to know about, whether it's working late night comedy, sketch comedy?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest misconception that people have about working in Hollywood is who works in Hollywood. You know, there's there's obviously a kind of a public facing element of Hollywood that is very glamorous and is very star driven, and we see a lot of red carpets and press events, but the kind of nuts and bolts of Hollywood is really people who get up early and get to set at 4 o'clock in the morning. And you know, these are, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between these people and someone in a non-entertainment city who's getting up at 4 o'clock to show up on a construction site.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, there's a lot of the same kind of just go at it worker mentality that gets it done. And it's definitely one of those places where you will always be amazed at who is doing what.
I'm thinking as you're describing this, almost like, you know, the tip of the iceberg is the show and the celebrity, and but there's so much below the surface.
There really is.
Hundreds of people just making this happen, but we just see, you know, this sketch comedy show or this sitcom. So
yeah, and that ultimately is the idea behind entertainment, right? You're supposed to, the idea is just show them the finished product. No one is supposed to know how the sausage gets made. Because it's an illusion. It's a magic trick. There's a feverish amount of work going on behind the scenes. That was probably the biggest surprise I got when I got to town.
Just how frenetic everything was, and
how much infrastructure goes into everything. I mean, when I was a student making student films, you know, I remember thinking we were owed a decent script. The performances aren't terrible. We're using professional cameras. Why does it look like garbage? Why does it sound like garbage? Why doesn't it feel like a real movie?
Yeah.
And then I got on a real film set and I realized, oh, because we had one camera guys, but it really takes three guys to move a camera. There's a guy who just focuses. That's all he does. And another guy moves the dolly and another guy points the camera. And when I started to understand the scale of productions, I started understanding why nothing I had made or been involved in making before that was up to snuff. so that's one of the things about the magic trick kind of idea, is that people don't realize just how much is involved in making something look smooth. It's, you know, it's one of the explanations for huge budgets for things, because it's a lot of manpower. It's a lot of equipment. You know, there's a specialized tool that does just that one thing. And if you don't have it, that camera's never going to move like that, or that voice is never going to sound that way. Or, that was a real eye opener for me, the scale of productions.
So what did the average day look like? You mentioned getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or going to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, I started as most people in the business do, as a production assistant, working for a production company, shooting a lot of location stuff. And daylight is a huge part of the equation. So as soon as it's bright enough for you to start shooting, you need to start shooting, because you're guaranteed going to run out of time at the end of the day. So everybody who has to do work before the first shot rolls has to be done with their work by the time it's bright enough to shoot the first shot. So there's a lot of people out there early in the morning, especially if you're shooting away from your studio, you know, where you might have an hour drive out to location, and then there might be a couple of hours of laying cable or setting up printers or whatever work needs to be done before you roll. And there's a lot of people out there early hours doing that. And then those same people have to wrap it all up after the last shot is shot at the end of the day. So it's, yeah, it's long days. It's tough work. But, you know, you're working in Hollywood. It's better than working in, I don't know. I don't want to disparage anybody else's job, but there's a lot of stuff that's tougher to do. So
I was going to say, are there any times, because I do this with audio all the time now, is when you catch somebody's slip up, where you see that little frame that seems a little bit off from the other one, or the part where somebody starts speaking and then you hear the little weird inflection in their voice in the middle of their sentence? How often do you get that?
Yeah, it's constant. It's always there.
Always there.
And I guess there are, you know, there's a little bag of tricks you pick up along the way, how to hide little things. And, you know, you can take a little flub out of somebody's line without having to make a cut in the picture and go somewhere else to hide it. And you learn when you can and when you can't.
Yeah.
And it's also something that I think there's a real relationship that develops between editors and directors as well, where you start to get comfortable with each other and appreciate what everybody's bringing to the table. And one of the, you know, it's a collaborative business, making film and television. It's not an individual art. And the sooner you learn that, the better you're going to be at it.
Because that just inherently comes with relinquishing control. Like, if you recognize it's collaborative, you're not going to try to, you know, draw a line in the sand and say, I want it this way and I want there to...
Well, I once interviewed for a course for a place in a master's program, and the director of the course, when he interviewed me, he posed me with a hypothetical scenario. He said, you're a director of photography and you're working on a set with the director of a film, and he wants to do something a certain way, and you strongly believe it's the wrong way, and you have a better idea that you know will work better, but he's sticking to his guns. What do you do?
It's like a trick question.
Right? It is like a trick question. And you know, the I gave whatever answer I gave, which I think was something to the effect of, I would, you know, if I felt strongly about it, I would make my point and I would try and convince him to take a look at my approach. And my answer wasn't the important part of this. His explanation or his answer to me was the important part. It's just the one sentence that sticks in my mind. He said, a film set is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship. And in many respects, he's right about that. It is a dictatorship, and it has to be. There has to be a chain of command, and there has to be a process of decision making that moves in one direction. Otherwise, it's chaos. And the director is the dictator, but, you know, he needs a party behind him. He needs everyone pulling in the same direction, and conflict is a killer. In an edit bay, you know, the best day's work you'll do is when everybody gets on the same page and starts humming along with each other, and then you feel like a team and you feel like you're working towards something. But the team, you know, teams have leaders and they need to have leaders, and a director is very much the vision, or should be the vision, on any film that's getting made.
This feels like a great kind of segue into talking about the differences between this whole world that you came from in LA and this world that you now find yourself in, where you are essentially working for yourself now, right? You're taking your own pictures. You are your own editor. You are the dictator now.
Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit about the gallery. So you and your wife, Jen, started Vaulted Gallery in October. Really recently, right?
Yes.
Or when did you guys actually move into the space, start working with that space? A couple months ago?
So I think our landlord turned the space over to us, I think it was October 18th.
Okay.
And we were open for the art walk the first our first art walk was the November art walk. That was our, that Saturday was our opening day.
That, so that was the first time I walked in the space. If you have not, if you're listening and have not visited the gallery, it is beautiful. It's an amazing, amazing space. The photos are amazing. Your wife's work is amazing. Tell us a little bit about, before we talk about the space, while I have this on my mind about like what it's like to work in film in LA, how different is it to take pictures for yourself? What are those two worlds like? Yeah. I mean, are you, when you're editing your own photos, are there similarities to the editing that you did in LA? Is it totally different? Are you looking for totally different things? I mean,
yeah, it's different in the, your critical eye is different. It has to be different. Editors are great at complaining about things. In a lot of ways, it's your job as an editor is to complain about things. This take doesn't work. That performance is too slow. That blocking is bad. But when it's your own work, it's a little bit harder to be honest about it. And you tend to fall in love with things and you think there's more there than maybe there is.
Is your wife a filter? Like, do you have somebody that you show pictures to and you're like, this is amazing? And they're like,
Yes. Yeah. My wife is very much my filter.
Yeah.
In that regard, in both directions, I would say as well.
Hmm.
She will, you know, I will sometimes show her something that I think is fantastic. And I just won't see the reaction on her face that I'm expecting. And it makes me, you know, it makes me take a second look and ask, all right, are you, you know, do you think there's something here that maybe isn't there? Or it's not coming through the way you think it is? But similarly, she's also, she'll also check my instincts for me in the opposite direction. Sometimes I'll think, oh, this isn't working. I was hoping that this shot was going to feel different. She goes, no, it's great. It looks good. You should don't throw it out. Work on it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she's very much a sounding board for me.
Do you feel like with photo, you know, and I was doing this in the gallery that, so for folks who haven't seen James's prints, there are these beautiful, most of them are landscape shots, right? Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, very much so.
So there are these beautiful, I don't know if they're wide angle or panoramic. Panoramic shots?
Yes. So they're all shot as panoramas. They may not present in their final form as a panorama because I think people are used to the used to a panorama being very wide and not that tall. But in reality, a panorama is really talking more about an angle of view. So if you're looking around almost a full circle, but you're also looking from below you to above you, it doesn't maybe look like a panorama. It still has a kind of a regular aspect. But if it's, you know, 300 degrees of view, it's very much a panoramic image. So almost everything I shoot is a panorama.
So when you look at these photos, they just invite so much examination. You know, there's so much detail that, like, I found myself doing this almost to my wife's chagrin, like, come on, let's move on. Let's look at the next one. I'm like, no, wait, look, there's more here. There's more here. Because it's like frozen in time and you get to just stand in front of it and get within an inch of it. Do you feel more pressure that these have to be absolutely perfect than you did when you were editing film? Like, is this almost like, okay, a film moment is over in an instant, you know?
Very much so.
And this is like, it's so exact. I don't know. It just seems like.
Yeah. Well, you're editing for a different level of scrutiny when you work on a still image versus a moving image. Editing video is very much about finding a way to get from A to B. And as long as that's smooth and it's not distracting, it'll usually work quite nicely. So the workflow, the concept of keep at it until you've ironed out all the little kinks is the same.
I'm dying to know what the process was like to start the gallery, to just navigate all the things required to do that. What has that been like? What's the process been like? Have you learned anything? I know it's so fresh and new. So far, what have you learned about it?
We're still learning things on a daily basis. A lot of that workload is taken on by my wife, by Jen. Jen has she has a lot of experience in retail. Her background throughout her working life has been in retail. And she has been running a small artisan business for a long time, much longer than I have. So I lean on her for a lot of that experience, which is hugely helpful. Mm-hmm. So she's really helped us navigate a lot of those waters. But yeah, it's a very different world. You know, when I worked in television, I was part of a big machine. I was one of 200 people who would show up for work on a show on any given day, mm-hmm. more on some days. And there is a plan put in place by other people who have spent a lot of time planning it out. And they present you with what's needed from you, and you can focus on that thing. It's very channeled. It's very, mm-hmm. very specialized. And you get used to being very good at one thing. Now I've got to find a way to be good at a whole bunch of things that I'm not used to doing, mm-hmm. that I don't, you know, that I'm not familiar with.
What about getting to Astoria? What's the story there?
So the story, getting to Astoria, was a kind of a long and circuitous one. So we had decided all the way back in 2013 that we wanted to move out of LA. I decided that I was ready to make a career change. I'd been editing for a long time. I was looking for a new way to spend my time. I wanted to focus on my photography. So we decided to move out of LA. It took me 3 years to actually pull the trigger on that, because it meant leaving behind a lot of security. It meant putting a pin at the end of a career and making what I hoped would be a lateral move, but turns out sometimes to change ladders, you got to climb down a bit before you can get on the new one. So we started a road trip, a kind of a never ending road trip almost, in 2016, looking for a new place to live. I wanted to get out of the city. I wanted to get closer to the kind of environments that I wanted to photograph. I wanted to spend more time in the woods, on the coast, in the mountains. So we started coming north up the coast and kept looking for... So we kept coming north up the coast and kept looking for a place that might feel like home. And last year... We started doing the Oregon coast, and we just started falling in love with it. We saw the Oregon coast ticking a lot of boxes that we hadn't been ticking in other places that we were looking for. It felt vibrant. It felt like it had a good art scene. It felt like there was good infrastructure, good connectivity between the coast and the freeways, and it felt doable to us. It felt like what we want. It felt like opening a gallery was not going to be maybe as prohibitively expensive as it might be in some of the more obvious places, like maybe a Carmel or another well-known art town in, you know, on the California coast, which is a little closer and more familiar to us. It was maybe not as exclusive, or the entry point was maybe not as difficult. It felt viable. It felt like it was attainable. But it also felt more like the kind of place we wanted to be. I don't know. There's something very comfortable about this area for both of us. It reminds me a little bit of home in a lot of ways. The landscape, the people, the lifestyle, the way people spend their time is a little bit more like what my wife and I were used to from our respective homes.
When you first saw the gallery space here, did you just know, oh my gosh, this is it? Was it kind of like you walked in and boom?
Yes, and we came to that space quite by accident. We had been looking at we looked at a space or two in town, and we had just earlier, just that day, looked at a space and thought it's a maybe, but it'll take a lot of work. And we came out of the viewing of the space and we walked up the street and we saw a for lease sign in the window, and we got up on our tiptoes and started looking in the window. I thought, oh, this space looks interesting. And a voice from behind us said, you guys look like you're a little bit more than interested in that. Do you want to go in and see it? And it was the project manager for the remodel of the space.
Cool.
And he didn't have a key for the front door, but he took us in through the Norblad and down through the basement, through the bowels of the building, and we came up through the basement door and stepped into the space for the first time. And I think Jen and I looked at each other and just gave each other one of those sideways looks and looked at the space, and I think we both kind of mouthed, this will work.
Cool.
And we've been trying to find a way to make it work since.
Cool. Well, James Crowe, I know there's a million things that I still want to talk about, but we are trying to keep it to 30 minutes here. I really appreciate that you came on and talked to us today. You're so welcome in Astoria. I hope you guys are feeling like it's been a smooth transition so far and people have made you feel welcome, but yeah.
Well, I have to say, we couldn't feel more welcome than we have since awesome. We arrived. I think Astoria is a great town with a lot going on and just a vibrant population who are interested in art and interested in people and interested in socializing. And it's, I think it's fabulous. We're really thrilled to be here.
Cool. Is there anything people should, kind of be aware of for the next couple weeks, next month or two in terms of the gallery? Anything happening with the gallery? If you want to go over like when you guys are open, when a good time to swing by and say hey and check out what you got going on?
We're open. The gallery is open Thursdays through Mondays from 11 a.m. to 5. Those are our winter hours. We're sticking with those for now, and we'll experiment with our openings as we get into the busier times of the year. We will, of course, be taking part in all the art walks. So if you want to see what we're up to month to month, the art walks are certainly a good time to see the new work. But we're open throughout the month, and we're happy to give mini tours to anyone who wants to come in and talk. I'm always happy to talk about photography.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. This has been great. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. And one of the things that James showed me was, again, that classical narrative of I had $1,000 in my pocket and I did something that I didn't know if it would work. I think that it's not a coincidence that we keep hearing this narrative repeated over and over and over again. It's because people who are willing to take chances are the people who are willing to find success. Risk is called risk for a reason. There's always the potential that we could lose something or that something bad could happen, but what drives us to power through risk is the reward at the end of the tunnel. And sometimes we're going to fail, and we all know that. What's important is that we keep working to the reward that we all know we want. And James was a perfect example of that. Whether it was in his journey into the film industry on the whole, or his journey up the coast and the creation of his own small business with his wife. It takes courage to do something that people will be impressed by. And it's important that we as people take time to find that courage, because it's not easy. And by taking time, we ensure that the things that we are pursuing are the things that we actually want to pursue. It keeps us true to ourselves, it keeps us true to our goals, and it keeps us true to what we want our futures to be. And finally, one of the most important things that I think we could pull from his story today is that for every single star out there, there is 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 hands behind them making them who they are. That it's not just the person who we see the most. It's not the person who's the most popular. It is every single person whose shoulders they stand on. So the next time you see some big event or happen to go to some big gathering, remember that it's not just the person who's standing and speaking at the front of the room who made that thing happen. Always be thinking of the faces in the background that make everything possible.